Today we have with us Constanza from the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, and also visiting Helsinki University. So she's going to present about taking the skill bias out of global migration. And she's going to stay here even this week. So if we don't have enough time today for all the questions that you are going to ask, you can still address the questions during this week. So thank you very much.
So thanks a lot for the invitation, and I'm happy to take questions throughout the week, throughout the talk, anytime. But I will also, I think, have some time at the end of the talk itself for discussion. So that's the plan, at least. So I'm talking about taking the skill bias out of global migration, and this is joint work with Michal, Ben, and Joel. And it starts from a basic fact. And the fact is that everybody is pretty much concerned about who migrates as much as how many migrates. So migrant-sending countries are concerned about losing certain groups of skills, for instance, from their home population, and that might affect growth, for instance. Migrant-receiving countries are concerned about receiving only, for instance, the highly skilled migrants from developing regions. So the policymakers and the political discussion is usually centered around the question of who migrates. And the goal of this paper is simple, but I think quite informative to the discussion. Because what we will try to do is to provide, to quantify the effect of skill bias migration. And we will look not only at one side of the coin, we will not only look at the developing countries, but we will also look at developed countries. And so we will try to have an idea about the global welfare impact of skill bias migration. And of course, I'll become clearer as we go along in the talk of what we mean about these different terms. So let's before I dig into the paper itself, I will provide some basic facts and some descriptive evidence of skill bias migration. And a good starting point, despite what some politicians also in Italy often say, is that immigrants tend to be positively selected in terms of skills. What do we mean? Think for a second about looking at the share of high-skilled among the immigrants and comparing that share in the total home population. What we often find is that this share is often greater than one. So for instance, if it was two, that meant that you find twice as many high-skilled people among the immigrants as you find in the total population. So I'm going to show you now a graph that points to this fact. And for at the moment, for descriptive reason, I'm even capping it. So what you have on the x-axis is just the current share of immigrants in different non-OECD countries. And on the y-axis, you have that measure of skill bias migration I presented in the previous slide, so just the share of high-skilled among the immigrants over the same share in the total population. So one would indicate that migrants are neutrally selected. They have exactly the same share in the home population as among themselves. And as you can see, across almost all countries in the world, all major sending countries in the world, immigrants are positively selected. That ratio is greater than one. The other thing you can notice is that, of course, there is quite some variation, not only in the number of immigrants across the world. There are some notable small islands or places where immigration is very, very high, Tonga, for instance. But there is also a lot of variation in terms of how much positively selected these immigrants are. Nonetheless, across many countries, selection is positive. You have down here Mexico, Kazakhstan, Russia as exceptions. And because we are in WIDER, and you have been doing lots of great work on selected countries, I will show you the same graph now on a couple of countries you have been working on before. And for doing that, I had to change the scale on the y-axis. So skill bias emigration for countries that you have been studying before is can be enormous. So first of all I have there just, again, some examples, and including Tonga and Jamaica, just to give you a reference. But all the countries, Brazil, India, US, South Africa, Ghana, China, Mozambique, and there are a lot more that should be there for your work. But to give you an idea, Mozambique has a skill bias of 67, which means that you find that the emigrants abroad are 67 times more likely to have a high school degree, for instance, than those in the home country. So very high skill bias migration. And anyway, even China or Ghana, we are in the numbers around 10, 15, and so on. Of course, immigration, skill bias immigration, can vary also within sending and destination country pairs. So you can look at one specific example. We can focus on South Africa and look at how much variation there is in South Africa when we look at skill bias immigration. So this is what we have here. Again, we have emigrant stocks on the x-axis and skill bias on the y-axis. And you can see that across all possible destination countries where South Africa sends emigrants, across all of them, selection is positive. So emigrants are positively selected across all destination countries with some variation. There is also variation in how many emigrants go to Chile compared to the UK. But the main message is you have this selected group of people that move abroad, okay? And at the moment, I'm showing you now some maybe new graphs, but this is definitely not a new story. We have been talking about the brain drain for decades. So the buzzword brain drain has tried to identify this main issue of losing, say, the best and the brightest, and how that can have an effect on growth. There is a lot of research in this area. I'm not doing any, that's not a literature review, so. But the main message is that if this affects growth, we might need to think about restricting migration, maybe. We might need to think about taxing or creating incentives to stay, and so on. Now, the recent work in this area has also contrasted this finding, showing that migration themselves might have positive spillovers even in the sending countries, for instance, through remittances or altered incentives to invest in education, technology diffusion, trade spillovers, and so forth and so on. So it's probably not a monolithic view, the one about the brain drain, it's not anymore, but you should keep this in mind. I mean, we are not the first to say that there is skill bias migration. But the question is, okay, but what about the receiving country? What are the global implications of this phenomenon that has been studied? And this is where the paper is going. So what about the receiving countries? Well, we can do the opposite of what we have just done. I show you a graph that looks pretty similar, except that I'm looking at the OECD countries only, and I'm trying to figure out what is the share of the highly skilled among the highly skilled immigrants and how that compare to the share we would have if there was no skill bias migration. Again, if this share is larger than one, it means that the receiving countries have a lot more highly skilled migrants compared to what they would have in a different scenario. And this is for most receiving countries what we see. And of course, this is the result not only of individual decisions, but also of migration policy. And we are not saying anything about that. So we are just taking a picture of the world. This is the result of a series of factors. But what we see is again that destination countries receive immigrants that are on average 1.6 times as more educated as the one left behind. And of course there is variation once again. It's no surprise that certain countries that enact highly selected policies, such as Canada or the UK or Australia, they also are able to attract or to select more skilled immigrants than other countries. Again, you have a cluster of countries that are below the line of one, and that cluster includes Finland, includes Italy, Germany, so that's a major destination country. But overall, you have that in the receiving countries, migrants are positively selected. So what do we do? Once again, we will provide a global assessment. What are the implications in terms of utility, in terms of welfare, of this fact? And I will show you the impact on the sending countries, and I will show you the impact on the receiving countries, and the final question is, are there global welfare gains? Because that should tell us something about possible policy implications as well. As a preview, what we will show is that the welfare in sending countries, so some sending countries have a welfare around zero, welfare changes around zero, so others lose, while for the receiving countries, we primarily see welfare gains. So when we put those together, especially once you weight for total population in the world, the welfare gains exist. They are not huge, but they exist. Large countries such as India and China do not face major losses for skilled bias immigration, and this is where most of the results come from. So does it make sense before the end of the talk? Does it all make sense? In some sense, the intuition is relatively simple. You take productive workers and you allocate them to productive countries. The global effects will, of course, depend on a number of mechanisms. And we will address some of these mechanisms. Trade might matter. How much remittances are sent might matter. But as a whole, the results seem relatively positively. But the results will depend also on what is this counterfactual world we are discussing. So if we don't have any questions on the settings, the plan is that I will discuss exactly what I mean when we are comparing these two different worlds. And the model is a general equilibrium model, so I will not spend a lot of time on it. I'll just sketch it very briefly to give you some intuition on how it works. And then I'll jump into the results. If there are no questions about, if I convince you that migrants are positively selected, I think it's not an audience who are convinced, and I needed to convince you of that. All right, so what exactly are we doing? So if we need to quantify the effect of skill bias migration, we need to compare the current world that we observe with one in which everything else is left constant except the skill distribution of the migrants. So our main idea is that we keep the total stock of migrants constant. So if there are 10 million Mexicans in the US, we are not going to change the number of immigrants to the US. We keep them constant, but we change their skill distribution. So you can think of this as an probably unreasonable migration policy, where all of a sudden, instead of getting in the people we usually get in, we will randomly select migrants from our specific sending countries so that the skill distribution of these migrants would not resemble what we observe today, but would just be equal to the home population.
why not no migration?
Because that's a different question, right? Because most of the literature has really discussed the impact of going from zero migration to what we observe today. But this is a different question. Here we are really interested in quantifying the effect of skill bias migration. And to do that, you have to keep the number of migrants constant. What I will show you is to compare the impact of changing only the skill distribution to the impact of changing migration stocks. So the scale. So I will show you a comparison of scale versus composition. And that is going to be a very important point to make, especially for certain sending countries. In certain sending countries, including some of the ones that I mentioned earlier, Wider is interested in, actually the compositional effect explains most of the losses or gains to migration. In others, it will depend. So, but fair point. I'll show you something in that direction. But at the moment, really, what we want to do is let's keep the numbers constant and change the type of migrants, and let's see how this affects welfare in both sending and receiving countries. So again, migrants will have the same skill distribution of the total population. So I'll show you just some pictures to fix ideas again. So as you see, suppose you have two countries, Senegal and France, and Senegal is sending migrants to France. And you have, for instance, that, I don't know, 40% of individuals in Senegal are high-skilled people, let's say college degree and above. But the migrants that goes to Senegal are positively selected, which means that fraction of high-skilled workers is much higher once they move to France compared to what you would find back home. So the idea, once again, is then to compare this situation with one in which selection is the same. So you would have the same share of people, same share of high-skilled people at home as much as in France. And so the comparison is between the current world, where you have positive selection, with the world without selection. Another way to say it, you have seen this already, is the graph on from South Africa and the selection of South Africans in different destination countries. An alternative way to say this is that, again, we keep the number of migrants constant, but we pretend that they are neutrally selected. So the skill ratio that I showed you in the first slide is equal to 1. So the comparison will be between our world and the world without selection. So I'll say a few words about the research design, the model, and the data. So it is a calibrated general equilibrium model, and we have data from 146 countries. Unfortunately, the model does not account for one part of migration, which is very important and interesting, especially for sending and developing countries, and that is south-south migration. Nonetheless, we do account for south-north migration and north-north migration. So this is about 60% of total migration flows. The model is in the spirit of Krugman, 1980, and we calibrated to the 2010 world. So I'll show you in the next slide some of our data sources, but we are mainly interested in figuring out migration stocks in different countries, or bilateral migration stocks, wage ratios, and trade, and a few other characteristics of the economy. So we simulate this world without skill bias migration and compare it to a world with skill bias migration. And we look at changes in welfare due to skill bias migration. So just a few words on the model, and if you have questions, then I'll probably move those to the end, because I have a long appendix where I can show you the equations, but that's not my intention here. So the model has different parts. Of course, we have labor markets, which are going to be very important for us, and it's going to be very important to have labor markets with workers with heterogeneous skills, because we have high-skilled and low-skilled migrants. In the model, we'll also have medium-skilled, which I haven't really mentioned yet. Of course, we have a production sector, consumers, and we also have trade. So countries will trade with each other. In the baseline results that I'll show you pretty soon, that's all we have. So you might have questions and wonder about what about remittances or what about other types of mechanisms that you might have in mind. So some of them I will show you later, some of them we might not have addressed in the model, I don't know. You can ask me and I'll see whether I can answer. So the labor markets I mentioned, we assume are competitive, and we assume we have three skill groups. Ideally, you would want a continuum of skill groups. There is nothing magic about two or three or high-skilled and low-skilled. But of course, we are limited by data availability. So we'll have medium-skilled workers, low-skilled workers, and high-skilled workers. And skills are based on education attained. And we don't know in the data where you attained education, so you might have questions on that. We can ask and we can discuss. In the model, we assume that migrants and non-migrants are imperfect substitutes. And this is, of course, important in receiving countries. The production has two sectors. So we have a traditional sector and a manufacturing sector. So the traditional sector produces an homogeneous good under perfect competition, no trade, while in the manufacturing sector you have monopolistic competition, you have homogeneous firms, but you have free entry, except that you have some cost upon entry. The manufacturing sector has both tradable and untradable goods. I think what's interesting in the model, and it's pretty important actually, is the fact that we assume that consumers have non-empathetic preferences. What does that mean? So it means that everybody has to consume a certain amount of traditional goods. And this is particularly important when you put together developing and developed countries, because you need to have a certain amount of consumption to survive. But once you start earning income, there is an over-proportional shift towards consumption of the non-traditional goods. Okay, so we think that this brings some realism to the model. And this is a mechanism that matters. In the results. I have a slide, so I don't remember the number, but it is it's coming. And of course, we have a number of checks in which we change that proportional shift, because of course it's important. This is probably the mechanism that matters the most for the receiving countries, because that's where production happens. That's where it matters that you have high-skilled migrants that start to produce different types of goods, and so that brings you utility. So this is a channel that is important in the receiving countries more than in the sending countries. And then there is trade that, so firms trade, they have an iceberg cost, and I think in the next slide I'll tell you a little bit about what's the mechanism behind the model. So what will the model predict? So suppose you are a receiving country. We are in Finland. We are Finland, and we, in our counterfactual world, we replace low-skilled migrants with high-skilled migrants. So what will happen? Now we have more productive workers. We have high-skilled workers that are more productive. So the workforce becomes more efficient. The production costs go down. New firms enter the market. And this is where as new firms enter the market, consumers can consume a larger variety of goods. and therefore we are happier. So that's the channel that through which the model works. So at the same time, because you have more efficient firms, you have that aggregate prices will decrease and real income will increase. Trade will dilute this effect, which is called in the trade literature market size effect. And so you will have more varieties that get traded also across countries. So some of the positive effects, spillover effects of migration in the destination countries will also go to the other countries. Of course, this whole mechanism will have an effect also on wages within countries. So some workers will gain and some workers will lose, because some workers will face higher competition with people with their same skills, and other workers won't. So there are also issues of inequality. So this is, of course, I just mentioned it from the point of view of Finland, but you can switch it around from the point of view of ascending countries. So the ascending country will lose high productive workers, there will be less varieties produced, less efficiency, less consumption, less, and so on. So the model will put together population data from the data set we were discussing this morning, the data set on immigrants in OECD countries, 2010. It will put together, will try to calibrate some of the key parameters of the model, looking at trade data, GDP data, wage ratios, and so on. In the next slides, we have the parameters, and since you asked about what is the preferences for the consumption, the traditional good versus the other one, in our baseline we assume that the weight is 0.5, so they give the same weight to one or the other, and we experiment later in an appendix, we change those weights. And I think, yeah, we are ready for the results. So throughout the results, I will show you how much indirect utility changes from our world with selected migration compared to a world without selected migration, so a neutrally selected world. So it's a percentage change that I will show you.
So what's the social welfare function? What's this U?
I can show it to you at the end. It's a function, it's a CES function composite in the traditional good and the other goods.
But this is for the world as a whole?
For
the world as a whole, or is it country specific?
It's country specific. So not all parameters are country specific, so maybe I'm not jumping to that now, otherwise I have to go back to all the slides. So I show you the formula at the end, we'll get back to that.
But it includes some inequality aversion within countries.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. But not across countries.
Yeah. All right. And here we have the effects. So if we just look at average welfare, and I am reporting here just some of the countries once again, and again I have highlighted in them some South Africa or Ghana or India, Brazil, China, Mozambique. Those are the ones highlighted, but you have a number of countries. And you can see what is our main message at the moment. So from the ascending country perspective, to a world with selected migration compared to a world without selected migration, you have losses, not everywhere. So it depends on a number of factors, how large the migration flows is, how selected the migration flows is. But in certain countries you have losses, in other countries you have that you have a welfare change close to zero, around zero. This is just an average, of course. So the problem is that because we are changing the scale of distribution, we are also changing the base population. So the question is, maybe that average effect I just showed you is not the best way to go to measure the impact of skill bias migration. So what I will show you next is is something that tries to net out this compositional effect per se and just looks at the effect on the non-migrants, so on those that in both scenarios never leave the country. And so we call this welfare per never migrant or per non-migrant. So this was the graph I showed you at the beginning. The welfare per never migrant is smaller. And nonetheless, the main results are still there in the sense that you still have a loss for certain countries, countries where we saw that the emigration rate was very, very high, losing in the range of about 5%, 7%. For other countries, we are usually around minus 2%, plus 0.something%. So this is the sending country perspective, which is compatible with the literature on also on the brain drain, for instance. And we can now see look at the OECD countries. So here, and this is the half side of the coin that we haven't really, that the literature hasn't really looked at, because from the sending country's perspective, when you talk about selected migration, you tend to look at micro data and look at how individuals choose to migrate or not. What we see here, I have pinned out Finland, United States, and Canada as examples. You see that most most receiving countries have positive gains. Those countries that have in place very selected migration policies, of course, gain a lot from highly skilled migration. They gain a lot more compared to a world in which the migrants would just be randomly selected. And then, you have Finland, where we know there was relatively, but there is little migration, and they were also negatively selected. So the results there are very, very close to zero. So what about as a whole? The paper quantifies the global welfare effect on migration. So if you put those things together, what you see, according to both measures, is anyway a positive welfare effect of skill bias migration. Is, of course, that comes out of an equal distribution of gains and losses from migration. And that is one of the key issues as to why migration is such a hotly debated topic. So now we can go back to Yuka's point. So how important is skill bias migration compared to global migration? So how much does this particular counterfactual explain of the whole problem of migration, and comparing this to the scale of migration. Am I going backward? Probably yes. Here. Sorry, I think I... Never mind. Before we go there, what are the distributional effects? Sorry, is that one? No, it wasn't. Okay, so... So how does this compare to the scale of migration? So what I'm showing you here is our welfare effect of skill bias compared to the welfare effect that you would have in a world without migration. So going from current levels of migration to zero migration. And as you can see, the dotted line is the impact of migration, which is negative for sending countries and is relatively high if you have a lot of emigrants. But what you can observe is that in some countries, our impact of skill bias migration explains a large share of the total impact of migration. So take Ghana, where migrants, if you remember, were about 15 times more likely, more high-skilled than those that stayed behind. Ghana, skill bias migration in Ghana explains almost 50% of the total change in welfare coming from migration. The same is from Mozambique. How much the scale matters compared to the distribution depends on a number of factors and will vary across countries. For the receiving countries, again, that will vary. In some countries, the skill distribution explains a lot more than the scales. In receiving countries, it's the scale that matters more than in the sending countries. So to go back to the initial question, if you look at the light bars, which indicate the total welfare effect of migration per se, and you compare it with the welfare effect of skill bias migration, you can see that, of course, it's migration that brings the larger gains or losses. But especially in sending countries, the fact that it's a specific group of people that migrate explains a third of the total effect of migration. In the receiving countries, it matters less. So this is how the scale compared to the composition. Another thing we can look at is within country who gains and who loses from skill bias migration. And again, the intuition is relatively simple in the sense that this is a context in which you have that the highly skilled are competing with more highly skilled workers. And so what you see is that the real wages of low-skilled workers are benefiting from high-skilled migration because competition is not in the labor market is not there. And while the real wages of high-skilled workers are suffering, at least globally, and in OECD countries. Of course, high-skilled workers are becoming scarce in sending countries, and this is where you see that there are welfare, there are wage gains there. Okay, so we have a number of extensions, and I have 5 minutes. So I'll probably let you ask for them if you ask me later. Let's see. But what I wanted to do is to talk about a most plausible scenario. So the basic model has really only those mechanisms that we discussed. But one could wonder about the effect of remittances. One could talk about possible further investments in education back in the sending countries because we see that we have opportunities abroad. One could think about a TFP externality, a fact that because in the sending countries we are losing high-skilled workers, that will have an extra effect on total factor productivity, and that will hamper even more our growth. So we could include an externality on TFP that takes that into account. We could include the fact that migrants might foster trade by asking for specific goods, for instance. Another channel that we haven't really talked about is the fact that migrants in the receiving countries might not necessarily have the same jobs that they had before, or they might not be able to transfer the skills they had before. So we could talk about that skill. So there are many mechanisms that one could add to the model to make it more plausible. What I'll show you next is what happens if we take all these mechanisms into account. So not one by one, but let's have a model that is maybe closer to reality than the one I showed you before. So this is our most plausible scenario, that's how we call it. And again, the effects will depend on the parameters and the choice of parameters that you have. Let's say we vary from a most plausible scenario that is relatively minimalist, so with smaller effects on remittances, brain drain, and so on, with one where the world is fantastic and the elasticity, the various elasticities are very high. So once again, we will look at sending countries and receiving countries. I think results are easy to understand if you think that the baseline model I showed you before was the most basic and the most negative one could have. There were no remittances, no other effects and channels. So all the other effects tend to deliver results that are where losses are lower, where there are losses, or gains are higher when there are gains. And this is similar also in the receiving countries. So as a whole, when you put together the model with all the different extensions, depending on how optimistic you are, you might even have a reversal of the effects in the sending countries. I think the main message I would like you to remember at the end of the day is maybe not to focus necessarily on the number itself, but to focus on the fact that globally there seems to be welfare gains from skill bias migration. So that's my conclusion, and I think I am on time. So there seems to be global welfare gains, but if you remember those bars, there are also important consequences, distributional consequences. So the effects are positive, but because they are mostly positive in the receiving countries, the sending countries, not all, but there are losses in many sending countries. And so the questions are, as often in this area, is again winners and losers. And one could think of, maybe we could, well, in an utopic world, we could think of mechanisms to compensate one and the others. In the real world, I'm not sure. That's why we need political scientists. But that's the main message of the talk. So thank you.
Thank you. We have some time for questions.
So I can go back to your
utility,
utility
yes.
Function.
I was also asking how to aggregate for the global, because it's like the sum of
the
global gains and losses for countries. So there is
it's weighted by population.
But so it's not considering a possible increasing inequality between those in rich countries and those in poor countries.
No, so that, and that's the main, also the message a bit of the paper, right? So you have this inequality
between countries.
And that's the, yeah. So it's a weighted average of consumption in the traditional sector and the other goods. And then it's a CS in the...
That's the consumer.
That's the consumer.
But what about the social welfare function?
Yes, so the social welfare is going to... We have aggregated as an average of across countries.
But there's no preferences in the utility function for world inequality. I think that's...
No, okay, no. So.
But even within?
For inequality, no. So.
But inside the country, is there a preference for inequality?
The ratio,
no.
For example, between skilled and unskilled workers is part of it? No.
That's just calibrated. It's a calibrated parameter, but there is no...
Has not effect.
Does not.
There's no Atkinson or whatever inequality aversion factor.
As far as I know, I can check with my co-author, but no, not as far as I know.
But isn't it?
But that somehow is important in the conclusions, no? Because when you say that it's a gain globally, well, it's, you have to be specific about what is a gain. What do you mean by a global gain?
So here we are. Yes, it's a simple aggregation,
actually it's a bit related to that. I understand correctly, you're basically comparing two states, there's no dynamics in it, right? Because something that came to my mind is you're talking about education and basically selection on education, but in reality the selection is not just happening actually on education, which we then observe in the data, but it's often mostly happening on the fact that it's young men migrating, often the...
Yeah.
It's changing a bit, but still a large fraction of people migrating is young men, particularly from developing countries, and that does mean something for demographics as
yeah.
well. And that's why also the question came about the dynamics, and I think that kind of also put some, let's say, caveats or challenges to how you can interpret the results, I think.
Yeah, I agree. So at the so this is really a picture, and the results are based on just changing skills, and it is definitely a static model. The only dynamics that we have introduced that anyway don't go necessarily in your direction are brain gain effects. So we can look. So we can. So it's dynamic in the sense that we can change the incentives to invest in education and let them depend on how many high-skilled immigrants have we lost in the current war compared to the others. So it's still a static model, but at least it has this flavor of including further changes due to the fact that others have gone. And let me see. So again, depending on how you parameterize those, you can have more or less optimistic views on the effects. But if you think that, because I see that immigrants are having more chances, high-skilled immigrants are having more chances by emigrating, I invest more in my own education, of course you'll have lower losses in the sending countries compared to our baseline mm-hmm. results, right? We don't have that.
So how you should take into account that some of those migrants, they return to their original country with new skills and...
Yes,
and
so we don't have, and we don't have return migration at all here because cross-country return migration data are impossible. One mechanism that goes in that direction could be remittances, the fact that migrants might send back income. And again, of course, you can imagine that the effects are similar. Remittances will reduce the negative effects in sending countries. So they will not matter in receiving countries. So aggregating in a simple way as we do, the global effects would be still.
But somehow, the remittances and other issues explain why developing countries are not closing migration, no? Because otherwise, if there is only losses, they should have the incentive to
so
stop migration.
I mean, there might be a number of mechanisms through which those losses are reduced. And I think the paper was at least looking at two groups of countries, right? Again, the literature has done the macro effects on the sending countries, much less so on the receiving countries. On the demographics, it's totally true. But my co-authors are working on that, so we couldn't write a paper.
Also, you had a question on the remittance specification. It wasn't clear to me, because if you think about low-skilled and high-skilled migrants from south to north, it's a feature of the data that mostly high-skilled migrants don't remit as much as low-skilled migrants. Two reasons for that. There's this what is called a myth of returning. Low-skilled migrants think they will go back to their own country, depart because they're not very sure they're going to stay on in the receiving country for too long. Think about in Germany when the Turkish migrants are there, it's not very clear whether they stay on or not. That's one reason. The other reason, of course, they have families to support. That's why they migrate in the first place. So I'm not sure, because in that case, if you do shift it from skilled bias to neutral migrant stock, it's not very clear to me then how the remittance effects are, because that would really shift remittance flows, right? That might really have implications. So it was not clear that, are you assuming that remittance behave the same across the different migrant stocks, which may not be right. And that's another thing is that south-south migration tends to be positively selected on low-skilled migration, more or less. I mean, there may be some exceptions. Think of the Gulf, right?
So there
the argument there that in that case, of course, you have very positive welfare gains for the sending country because they get this huge remittance flows in.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering how remittance has been treated, because that will make a big difference in how you think about them.
So I think in the paper at the moment we have three cases, one in which it's just a fixed amount that is remitted regardless of the skill, and one in which you every migrant remits a share of its income. So this is what we have in the paper. We did check actually at some point the fact that maybe the highly skilled remit less or more compared to the low skilled. The fact is that we, for remittances, because we are keeping the stock of migrants constant, the composition matters, but it will matter only if you have a lot of immigration. So we never really found enormous, especially globally, but of course they matter for receiving countries, but we never found enormous changes in our conclusion. Here, though, I don't have the check that you were wondering about. We did try it at some point, and I think it didn't overturn the results, also for the sending countries. But these are our remittances effect. Of course, they don't matter in receiving countries, and they dampen the negative effects in the sending countries, which is, I think, what you were mentioning earlier.
Any more questions?
Yeah.
Your descriptive statistics at the beginning included things on Britain, which would be useful in the Brexit debate.
Ah, would it?
There was actually one which showed that Britain had the
of course.
Most skill bias.
Yes, I think it does.
I think you should write an op-ed. Because I think people don't realise that. Britain and Canada were right at the top down.
Yeah.
So, I think that. But my other thing was one of your slides, which was counterintuitive to me, which was. Are you going to use the description?
Where are we? Because it's not only Britain, it's not just Brexit, right?
But there was one right near the beginning, which was very powerful. But the other one, your baseline comparison of skill bias and the effects of the numbers of migration, that seems counterintuitive to me. Just to look at that, that was the one. That was
this
the one,
I think, right?
No, the other one, which was that one. For the OECD, that's...
Well, I think the fact, I mean, there is literature that shows that migration is welfare improving in the receiving countries as well, especially if you think of these models where you have more goods that are created, you have more people, you produce more.
I would just think the difference wouldn't be so big. I would think the skill bias would be bigger in relation to the scale.
I mean, if you think about it, you are changing just the skill composition of numbers. So take 10 million Mexicans. It's more the numbers that matters than the skills, especially in these countries where the numbers compared to the total population are not huge. So you are really changing only marginally the skill composition rather than the numbers. So going from zero Mexicans to 10 million should matter more than changing, I don't know, 500,000 people high school degrees. That is not the case, of course, if you go to sending countries like Tonga, where 97% of the population is abroad. Then of course, the skills matter because you also have a size of a number of people that is substantial.
But were you surprised by that?
I don't know. I think it is a relatively big number, especially if you look here. So these numbers are found in the literature. The scale effects are known. I don't know if I had a prior. But this also means that, again, maybe the policy discussion should be different. Maybe.
Right. I wonder what the possibilities are for including
think actually it is possible now. So when we started the project, there was no, in the DIOC, there were no south-south migration. But I think actually it is possible now. What I would expect at the macro level, so what might be trickier though is to calibrate all the other, to get wage ratio and everything else. So I'm not sure if we would really be able to do it, also including south-south migration.
But you can do it for a small number of countries, or somehow a big number.
Sure. So we could write a paper, of course, on south-south migration, and I think that would probably be even more important, given how important south-south migration is becoming, especially for developing countries. What would I found? I'm not sure, because they are then receiving, they are both sending and receiving countries, and it will depend on again the skill compositions of who comes and who goes. So I just have a bit of experience with South Africa, which I was talking with Simone, and there again, especially if you are sending high-skilled migrants and receiving low-skilled migrants, the two effects will not necessarily compensate. So I'm not necessarily going to be, I mean, I don't think I would see a reversal of these results necessarily. But it shouldn't, again, it will depend on what is the counterfactual then we have in mind. And as a whole, we would, I think we should be around this baseline result, assuming that we, it will depend on the skills.
Do you take into account the occupation? Do you break that down? Because if you want to look at the welfare effects here, do you break that down? So I was just thinking aloud. You've got two skilled people from, say, Ghana, who is moving out. One is a medical doctor, the other is missing. You don't expect in terms of the welfare effect, the what do you call it, the competition of your kind of factor. You don't expect to have the
So I think there are two questions. The first is that if the losses coming from the losses of the economists is going to be larger than another, and I think that's your question. No, we don't have. We don't say anything about that. But the second question that can come from your question is whether the economist living from Ghana will be an economist in the receiving country, and that's a different issue. So usually you find that you have some downskilling of migrants. Once you know skills are not perfectly transferable across countries. So that is something we have taken into account in the model. But we have not taken into account, we have not tried to qualify or quantify the effects of having different occupations and losing people with different occupations. We disregard occupations and just look at skills in terms of educational attainment.
Is that something you understand?
I'm sure it could potentially matter. I think we might. I mean, at least the literature is not used to think in terms of that, but maybe we should change.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's where this structural transformation program should go to.
Okay, so thank you.
Thank you for the questions.